Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Sutta Study class. Today we're going to be looking primarily at Sutta number 52 of the Majjhima Nikaya, the man from Attika Nagara. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. So this weekend I've been teaching on the four Brahma Viharas, the four boundless states, metta, loving kindness, karuna, compassion, mudita, joy or gladness in the happiness of others, and upekkha, equanimity. And I've chosen this sutta this afternoon to continue teaching on that subject. But I've chosen the suttas and the teachings this weekend with a particular purpose in mind, and that is to show that the cultivation of the four Brahma Viharas is an integral part of the path of practice. Very often we think of the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas as something that's a side issue or not central to the development of calm and insight, and particularly if we're focusing on the development of wisdom, on the development of insight and vipassana meditation, we may not realize how central the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas is to preparing the mind so that it can be used for the development of insight, to see things as they really are. And there are a few ways in which we traditionally hear about the value of the four Brahma Viharas. We hear about the development of loving kindness to overcome ill will, the development of compassion to overcome thoughts of cruelty, also to overcome a coldness towards the suffering of others, to overcome resentment, the cultivation of both loving-kindness, compassion and mudita are encouraged by the Buddha, to overcome jealousy and avarice. The cultivation of mudita is encouraged, and then the cultivation of equanimity so that we can maintain the balance of our mind in both the ups and downs of life. I always fall back on that phrase because it covers so much. But as well as cultivating these qualities in order to overcome the defilements in our emotional life, in our relationships, we also cultivate these meditations so that we can overcome craving. And this is one of the fundamental roles that the deep concentration states, the mental absorptions provide, act as their purpose is to provide us with a rich inner life, a feeling of fulfillment and inner satisfaction, so that we no longer seek after sensory pleasure. And as we develop that rich inner life, that inner wealth, and we no longer feel so lacking, so unfulfilled, so desperate to go and get something to make us feel better, anything that's a sensual pleasure, then more and more contentment arises in the mind, more stability arises in the mind. So the equanimity is an outcome of developing those positive states of mind which lead to contentment and inner peace and cut away at craving. And the development of the four Brahma Viharas is one of the most obvious ways in which we start to cultivate this feeling of being complete, of having enough without needing to go out and top up with sensuality through pursuing pleasurable sense contacts. And so not only in order to progress in meditation to the point where the mind is able to dwell inwardly and not be drawn out, in order to be able to cultivate what one of the qualities we need to practice insight in our daily life, wise attention. If you think about what wise attention involves, it involves being able to observe one's experience and not fall into one's old habit patterns, to not follow one's usual tendencies in paying attention to anything that has come into our range of attention. We need to be able to observe that thing with a modicum of detachment, to hold it up for inspection without just immediately identifying it in terms of our usual way of looking at things. And so, for example, the Buddha gives as the reason why unarisen ill will comes into being, it's because of an unattractive or repulsive object. That means something that we've come in contact with previously and we have invested it with those qualities of we don't like it, it's not nice. It's something that gives rise to an unpleasant feeling. And the way that we cut across ill will that has already arisen is to be able to look on that object with loving kindness or compassion. Now, if we want to start to observe the things that we don't normally pay much attention to, or start to pay attention to the things that we don't like, but which we need to be able to maintain our awareness on so that we can see it in its true nature without just jumping off into our old ideas about that thing, we need to be able to stay watching it. We need to be able to be detached from it and somewhat detached from our usual reaction, aware of what's going on. And in order to do that, we need to have a mind which gives us much more of a bird's eye view of that thing rather than the view that you get right at eye level. And so the expansion of the mind, the development of a sort of buffer in the mind that is produced through the cultivation of the four Brahma Viharas, allows us to hold unpleasant objects in that wise attention without just following our ordinary, normal way of looking at them. And because we have this inner fullness, inner satisfaction, it allows us to look at the objects that we usually consider to be beautiful, wonderful, we want them, without immediately getting sucked into that kind of reaction. Because the other reason, the other aspect of craving that the Buddha points out is the reason why unarisen craving or desire arises is because we come in contact with a beautiful object. And once we come in contact with the beautiful object, that triggers the internal desire or craving within us. And if we have already developed a mind which is more buoyant and spacious, which is bright and light, which is feeling more complete in itself, then when we come in contact with beautiful objects which previously just pull us in to craving, then we have that ability to use wise attention, supported by that buoyancy of mind, to really examine that object and perhaps see it in a new light. So the cultivation of the Brahmaviharas is to help us challenge the defilements and to purify the emotions so that our loving kindness becomes more or more free of self-centeredness, helps us to cultivate deeper states of meditation and particularly to cut across craving. And then it helps us to be more mindful for the development of insight in our daily life. And those aspects of loving kindness, I think sometimes we don't realize, we don't appreciate how central the cultivation of these states are to all other aspects of the path. So even if you think about the ability to maintain one's precepts, if you're feeling very miserable, if you're feeling full of anger, if you're feeling full of desire, then it becomes a struggle to resist the pull of craving or the pull of ill will. And sometimes that can mean that we break our precepts to fulfill our desires. But if we have this inner strength, this inner buoyancy, then it becomes much easier to see where we're going and to protect ourselves before we get to the point of breaking precepts. And so these four Brahmaviharas are really central to the whole of the cultivation of the path. Now, having said that as an introduction, I'll go through this sutta, which is a sutta which isn't taught by the Buddha himself, but is a teaching from his disciple, Venerable Ananda. And it doesn't, I'm not aware of whether this was a teaching that Venerable Ananda gave before the Buddha passed away or after the Buddha's passing away, but I'm hazarding a guess that it may be after the Buddha's passing away when people were coming to Venerable Ananda and asking him questions about the teaching. But I'm not sure about that, and the commentary doesn't mention that. So I'll begin by reading the sutta. And actually, the points that I want to get to occur through the middle of the sutta, so I'll just read through until it comes to a point where I need to explain. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Venerable Ananda was living at the Belowa Gamaka near Vaisali. Now on that occasion, the householder Dasama of Atakanagara had arrived in Pataliputta for some business or other. Then he went to a certain bhikkhu in Kukuta's park, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and asked him, "Where does the Venerable Ananda live now, Venerable Sir? I wish to see the Venerable Ananda." "The Venerable Ananda is living at Belowa Gamaka near Vaisali, householder." So these places which are mentioned are still in existence today in India. Vaisali is to the northeast of Buddha Gaya, where the Buddha attained enlightenment, and Pataliputta is present-day Patna, which is to the north, slightly to the west of Buddha Gaya. So they're all in the same general vicinity of Buddha Gaya, but a couple of hundred kilometres from there. So when the householder Dasama had completed his business at Pataliputta, he went to the Venerable Ananda at Belowa Gamaka near Vaisali. After paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and asked him, "Venerable Ananda, Has any one thing been proclaimed by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, wherein if a bhikkhu abides diligent, ardent and resolute, his unliberated mind comes to be liberated, his undestroyed taints come to be destroyed, and he attains the supreme security from bondage that he had not attained before? And these are all ways of saying that the bhikkhu became fully enlightened. The supreme security from bondage is talking about enlightenment. So this is a description of the arahat. And Venerable Ananda says, "Yes, householder, one such thing has been proclaimed by the Blessed One." "What is that one thing, Venerable Ananda?" "Here, householder, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a bhikkhu enters and abides in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion." This is a standard description of the jhanas in the Majjhima Nikaya, but you would be, if you've been listening to Achyam Brahm's explanations for a time, you'll know that the applied and sustained thought is applying the mind to the meditation object and sustaining the attention on the meditation object. It doesn't mean discursive thinking. It means applying the mind to the meditation object and sustaining the mind on that object until the object, the meditation object itself, disappears and one is only with the mind, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. He considers this and understands it. This jhana is conditioned and volitionally produced. But whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. Standing upon that, he attains the destruction of the taints. But if he does not attain the destruction of the taints, then because of that desire for the Dharma, that delight in the Dharma, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, he becomes one due to reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes and there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. This is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One who knows and sees, accomplished and fully enlightened, wherein if a bhikkhu abides diligent, ardent and resolute, his unliberated mind comes to be liberated, his undestroyed taints come to be destroyed, and he attains the supreme security from bondage that he had not attained before. So this is the classic description of the jhanas, and this is the classic description of how one uses the jhanic experience for the development of insight. This contemplation on how the jhana has come to be and its qualities of being according to the three characteristics of existence, this contemplation takes place after the jhana. It's not what takes place in the jhana. In the jhana, the mind is focused on the meditation object to begin and then moves into just being focused on the mind. The mind, at that point, there is no active doer, as Achyam Brahm mentions in the way that he describes it. There's only the knowing of experience. But then afterwards, one considers and reflects on what has been experienced. And in this particular description, it's not just the experience of the jhana as being pleasant, but it's how that jhana comes to be and the fact that it is conditioned and it is volitionally produced. So this, in this way of reflecting, it is understanding that one has attained this state of meditation through having that as one's goal, that one knows one wants to go in that direction, and so one produces the right conditions for that to arise. Saying that it's volitionally produced does not mean that one has produced it through willpower. even though the word for volition, which is chetana, which is a sankhara, one of the sankhara aspects of the mind, in the mind when we talk about the being as made up of the five khandhas, the body khanda, the rupa, then there is the vedana, the feeling, the perception, the sanya, the consciousness of the senses, the vijnana, and then there is the sankhara, which includes thinking and includes willpower or will, wishing. It also includes putting forth effort to reach a goal, making a determination to accomplish a certain result. And in order to accomplish this result, one has to know what one is aiming for. So one has to know the direction that one is going in. And then to accomplish this result, which is to attain the first jhana, one needs to put in all the necessary ingredients. And that is how it is conditioned. So you have an idea of where you want to go, but you can't just get there by wanting it, just through desire, just by saying, that's what I want. But you have to then put in the necessary conditions so that eventually what is arising is produced as a result of those conditions being present, not produced simply through willpower. But if there wasn't the desire in the first place to move in that direction, then you wouldn't put in the necessary conditions. So one contemplates that after the jhana. How is it that this has come to be? And one of the fundamental points that I would like you to, or like to put across is how the cultivation of those necessary conditions isn't just the things that we do that day or just the things that we're obviously aware of, sitting down to meditate or having a quiet place to meditate. It's all the other ways in which we use our mind when we're not sitting on the cushion, the way that we're living our life, the way that we attend to objects. And so when we're starting to investigate these conditions, we have to look a little bit further afield than just what's right in front of our face at that time. And that's why it's so important to know the place that practices like the Brahma Viharas play in that overall development of the necessary conditions. Sorry. Yes, I'm going to go on to that. Yeah. So this is where what's happening after the jhana is reflecting on what were the conditions and how did it come about, and that these conditions are impermanent and subject to cessation. So even though that one has attained the jhana, it's not one's personal property, because afterwards the jhana fades away. One sees that it doesn't arise just because we want it, we can't keep it. It's like everything else, it's impermanent. And standing upon that, he attains the destruction of the taints. And these are the asavas, the outflows which take us out into the world. There is the desire to be, the wish to exist. There is the craving for sensuality and to have things the way that we like them. And then there is the ignorance, which doesn't understand the basis for our suffering, for the dilemmas that we face in this life. And it says that if someone reflects on the first jhana in the way of that it's conditioned and it's volitionally produced, it's impermanent, it's not something that's one's personal property, then one can destroy the taints, can destroy these taints which bring us back again and again to rebirth. But if he does not attain the destruction of the taints, then because of that desire for the Dharma, that delight in the Dharma, With the destruction of the five lower fetters, he becomes one due to reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes and there attain final nibbana without ever returning from that world. So the first part that if he does not attain the destruction of the taints, then because of that desire for Dharma, that delight in the Dharma, this refers, according to the commentary, and it is mentioned in other suttas in described in much the same way, slightly different wording, that one has this desire for or still attachment and interest in the Dharma itself, still interest in pursuing meditation and developing insight, and that that desire for the Dharma, in one translation it's translated as the passion for the Dharma, that keeps one fettered, that one isn't able to break through the bonds of ignorance because one doesn't want to give up one's involvement with the meditation. Or not that one doesn't want to, that one isn't ready to. One is still investigating, one is still finding new aspects of Dharma, and because of that, one doesn't make the final breakthrough. Now, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, these are the fetters which bind us to samsara, and there are 10 fetters which are given as the things which gradually disappear as we attain stages on the path to enlightenment. And the 4 stages on the path to enlightenment, the stream winning, the non-returner and the arahat. And the 5 lower fetters are sensuality, attachments to sensuality, and ill will. And also doubt in the truth of the teaching, the truth of the Buddha as the teacher, belief in rites and rituals as a way of attaining enlightenment, and personality view, Sakkaya Ditti, which has as its basis the idea that there is a self that is existing independently, unchanging over time, that isn't conditionally produced, that arises independent of causes and conditions. And at the point of stream winning, the doubt in the truth of the Buddha's teaching is overcome because one experiences the truth of the teaching and the path for oneself. The belief that rites and rituals can, on their own, take us to enlightenment is overcome because we see that that's not how we got to the point of the path moment, that there has to be wisdom and insight there as well. And the other one, the Sakkaya Ditti, one sees that what one took to be me, the things, the attributes to do with my mind and my body, that give us this delusion of a self that is acting independently in the world, that isn't affected by outside causes and conditions, this is completely overcome at that time. And so one of the fundamentals is to see that even this self that we take to be me, that we take to be the center of everything, is actually conditioned and volitionally produced, and that it's impermanent and it's subject to cessation. So the personality view is overcome at the time of stream entry. Now, to go to the next level of the path to the once returner, who returns once more to the human realm, at this point greed and hatred are weakened. but the fetters aren't overcome until the point of non-returning, which is the third stage on the path. And then at the third stage on the path, not only the fetters of doubt and belief in rites and rituals and personality view are overcome, but greed and hatred are completely overcome. And so the five lower fetters, which tie one to the sensual world, that those are completely overcome at that time, and the non-returner does not return to the human realm, or even to the lower realms of the Deva realms, where there is the fine material beings. They return, they are reborn spontaneously in the pure abodes, which are states of being where beings don't have a body, they only have a mind. Now the five higher fetters, which continue to bind them to existence, is the first two of those fetters is a desire for rebirth somewhere, and this is a desire for continued existence. And even at the point where one is has overcome the idea of a self-existing me, an entity that's continuing through from lifetime to lifetime, that is independent or unchanging, even when one has overcome that wrong view, there is still the sense that there is something here that is existing, something that is experiencing whatever it is that we're experiencing in our life. And this continuing sense of something being here is supported by the desire to continue in existence. And because of this desire, that is one of the fetters that binds one. So the desire to be born in one of the Deva realms or in one of the higher Deva realms is one of those fetters. The other fetters which are still binding the non-returner is the restlessness, conceit, and ignorance. These are the three other fetters. Now, the restlessness is not the restlessness that you and I know of, where we can't sit still or we can't make the mind be peaceful when we want it to be peaceful or keep it on an object that we want to keep it on. It's a much more subtle restlessness which has to do with that urge to keep going. And it's the sort of restlessness which keeps us interested even in the Dharma, that allows us not to be ready yet to stop activity or mental activity. So this love of the Dharma can be where we continually look to find something new, explore something unexplored, and that restlessness keeps us from being totally still. The conceit is the still there's a sense of something here. If it's not the self that we know, if it's, we know that it's not this mind, we know it's not this body, but it's something here. This is still there, supported by ignorance, which hasn't fully penetrated the truth of the way things are. And the most telling story that appears in the suttas to help us to understand this very subtle remaining ignorance and this conceit, conceiving of oneself as something, not sure what exactly, is a teaching where a bhikkhu who was very venerated by his fellow bhikkhus was giving them some instruction, and they were saying to him that he must be fully enlightened if he could talk to them in the way he was speaking about the five khandhas. And he said, "No, I'm not fully enlightened, because I still have this subtle conceit subtle sense of something here. And he said, I'm not the body and I know I'm not the mind, but I'm something. And he said, it's like the perfume in a flower. You know that the perfume isn't in the stem of the flower. You know the perfume isn't in the petals of the flower. You know the perfume isn't in the color of the flower. But there's a perfume that lingers around that flower. And that sense of self is what's lingering around what I take myself to be. And as he was giving that teaching, he penetrated the ignorance that was keeping him bound. So this is a very, very subtle sense of being something but not being sure what you are, not the body, not the mind, but something. So if one hasn't broken those five higher fetters, then one reappears spontaneously in the pure abodes and lives there for a very, very long time and there attains final nibbana without ever returning from that world. So we're talking about using these jhanas for the contemplation of insight, which is directly related to the understanding of what we take ourselves to be. And if you consider that the experience of the jhanas is very pleasant and perhaps the pinnacle of one's experience of pleasure in this world, if you're able to penetrate and see that that is not something that you have been able to manifest with your will, that it's something that arises dependent on conditions, that it's not yours to keep, then that those two things, the fact that it's so superior to anything else that you've ever experienced, but it still isn't within one's control, that can propel one to very deep reflection about the nature of reality itself and about the nature of the self that has had the experience. And that's why it's possible with these kinds of contemplations to break through these fetters. John, does that explain enough of what? Yes, the taints, the asavas, we have bhav asava, avij asava and tan asava. They're all about, in another way of talking about clinging to existence and clinging to sensuality and clinging to our ignorance. They're just other ways of expressing what we know of greed, hatred and delusion, basically. So now we move on, and just because we're running close with time, this sutta goes on to talk about each of the jhanas in succession, all of them in the same way, that when one accomplishes the jhana, then one reflects afterwards that this second jhana is conditioned and volitionally produced. And the third jhana is conditioned and volitionally produced. And the fourth jhana is conditioned and volitionally produced. And whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. And standing upon that, he attains the destruction of the taints. Now, over the page, when we get to verse 8, this is where my theme for the weekend comes in, because after talking about the four jhanas as being the way to accomplish the destruction of the five lower fetters and to give rise at least to the state of non-returner, in verse 8 we have Venerable Ananda talking about the four Brahma-viharas as one of the ways that one can accomplish what one has accomplished through the four material jhanas. Again, a bhikkhu abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around and everywhere, and to all as to himself. He pervades, providing the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving-kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill-will. He considers this and understands it thus. This deliverance of mind through loving-kindness is conditioned and volitionally produced. But whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. Standing upon that, he attains the destruction of the taints. But if he does not attain the destruction of the taints without ever returning from that world, he is reborn in the pure abodes. This too is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One, wherein if a bhikkhu abides diligent, ardent, and resolute, he attains the supreme security from bondage that he had not attained before. Again, a bhikkhu abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion, without ill will. He considers this and understands it thus. This deliverance of mind through compassion is conditioned and volitionally produced. But whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. Standing upon that, he attains the destruction of the taints. But if he does not attain the destruction of the taints, he is reborn in the pure abodes without ever returning from that world. This is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One, wherein if a bhikkhu abides diligent, ardent, and resolute, he attains the supreme security from bondage that he had not attained before. Again, a bhikkhu abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with appreciative joy, without ill will. Again, a bhikkhu abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with equanimity, without ill will. He considers this and understands it thus. This deliverance of mind through equanimity is conditioned and volitionally produced, but whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. Standing upon that, he attains the destruction of the taints, but if he does not attain the destruction of the taints, he is reborn in the pure abodes without ever returning to this world. This is too is one thing proclaimed by the Blessed One, wherein if a bhikkhu abides diligent, ardent, and resolute, he attains the supreme security from bondage that he had not attained before. So it's not explicitly said that the bhikkhu or the practitioner enters the meditative state to cultivate this boundless loving kindness, boundless compassion, boundless appreciative joy, and boundless equanimity. But one understands that that's implicit here, that in order for the meditation to develop into immeasurable abundant qualities without hostility and without ill will, that one has to work in a progressive way, a gradual way, to develop the mind to that extent. And that as one is developing these qualities, one is already supporting the mind to do the work as I've suggested at the very beginning, to cut away at one's craving, to develop contentment and inner happiness, to be able to attend to the objects of one's perception with a much more balanced mind. But it's very significant that these four Brahma Viharas are mentioned in this teaching as ways that lead to the destruction of the taints. Not just the practice itself, but the contemplation of how one produces those refined emotional states, what are the causes and conditions that allow them to arise, support them, allow them to grow, and what is the experience of it, that it is impermanent, conditioned, and it comes to cease. Are there any questions about that? To cut down on ill will, yes, that is. Yes, sorry, thank you for bringing that up. in the list of the fetters that I mentioned to you, the first two that I mentioned are sensual desire and ill will. So craving for sensuality and ill will. And so in practicing these Brahma Viharas, you can see that there's a direct relationship between the states of mind that are produced through the cultivation of these states and starting to weaken the hold of the fetters. Because of craving and a lack of contentment, inner contentment, we pursue sensual pleasures. And because we never find complete satisfaction or lasting satisfaction, we're driven again and again to pursue sensuality. So we make that tendency stronger. If we have this inner happiness, this buoyancy of mind, which comes from the cultivation of these states, this feeling of being complete, being replete is another word, just fulfilled, full, not feeling like we're empty, like we don't have enough, then we don't pursue sensuality in the same way. We don't pursue it endlessly, mindlessly. And in the same way, if we are able to overcome ill will, if we're able to overcome all of its manifestations from ill will, just the basic irritation, going on to anger and hatred, if we start to cut away at those grosser states and then we move closer and closer to overcoming that ill will, which is the most, if you almost the minor, the weakest form of that aversion, then we are cutting away at that fetter. And once the once returner, which is the second stage on the path, has weakened the hold of ill will and the fetter of sensual desire, but it's only the non-returner who's completely overcome it. And so we need to keep cultivating these states, even though we have developed insight, even though we've understood that this self-centered view of the world, this self-cherishing approach to things that we have, even though we've understood that that's not based in reality, we still have the fetters of ill will and sensuality playing themselves out in our everyday life. And so the cultivation of these Brahma Viharas is extremely important to keep working away at that wrong way of attending to our experience. So I'm encouraging people to reflect on their centrality to the whole of this path. So if we proceed with this sutta, we see that the Buddha, that Venerable Nananda then goes on to talk about the other non-material jhanas, talking about in verse 12, again with the complete surmounting of perceptions of form, with the disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact, with non-attention to perceptions of diversity, aware that space is infinite, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of infinite space. He considers this and understands it. This attainment of the base of infinite space is conditioned and volitionally produced. But whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. Standing upon that, he attains the destruction of the taints. But if he does not attain the destruction of the taints, he's reborn in the pure abodes without ever returning from that world. And with the complete surmounting of the base of infinite space, aware that consciousness is infinite, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of infinite consciousness. And contemplates that after coming out of it, that this is conditioned and volitionally produced, it's impermanent, and through that contemplation leads to the destruction of the taints. Again, by completely surmounting the base of infinite consciousness, aware that there is nothing, a bhikkhu enters and abides in the base of nothingness. He considers this and understands this. This attainment of the base of nothingness is conditioned and volitionally produced. But whatever is conditioned and volitionally produced is impermanent, subject to cessation. Standing upon that, he attains the destruction of the taints, but if he does not attain the destruction of the taints, then because of the desire for Dharma and the delight in Dharma, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, he becomes one due to reappear spontaneously in the pure abodes and there attain final Nibbana without ever returning from this world. Now, when we hear about these higher attainments, they might seem very far from our actual experience, and also from where we've come to in our meditation, they seem almost beyond us. But the Brahmaviharas are much more within our grasp. They're much more something that we have some experience of. We have some experience of loving kindness, of compassion, of happiness and the success of others, and of being equanimous, maybe not to the same extent as the other three Brahmaviharas, but they are things which we can approach with much more confidence because they are things which we experience in our everyday life. And so we get lots and lots of practice of seeing what produces them, what allows them to arise, what strengthens them, what undermines them, and what benefit they are in our life. And so if we're looking for a means to be able to work at developing this path, we have something that is very close to our ordinary life, which we can use as our basis, as our foundation. And that again is one of the reasons for pointing out that what is some these things which are so much so useful for us in our ordinary everyday life and so much a part of our experience, our ordinary experience, can be put to even better use than just to give us happiness. Temporarily, they can be put to the use of overcoming the fetters and attaining stages on the path. So at the end of this sutta, when Venerable Ananda had spoken, the householder Dasama of Atikanagara said to him, "Venerable Ananda, just as if a man seeking one entrance to a hidden treasure came all at once upon 11 entrances to a hidden treasure, so too, while I was seeking one door to the deathless, I have come all at once to hear of 11 doors to the deathless." And the 11 doors to the deathless, the four material jhanas, the four Brahmaviharas, and the three immaterial jhanas. So again, just this wording, the 11 doors to the deathless, I think is something which sticks in the mind, and the fact that the Brahmaviharas are included in that is something to make us sit up and think about how powerful these states are. "Just as if a man had a house with 11 doors, and when that house caught on fire, he could flee to safety by any one of those 11 doors, so I can flee to safety by any one of these 11 doors to the deathless. Venerable sir, these sectarians will even seek a teacher's fee for their teachers. Why shouldn't I make an offering to the Venerable Ananda?" Then the householder Dasama of Atikanagara assembled the Sangha of bhikkhus from Pataliputta and Vaisali, and with his own hands he served and satisfied them with various kinds of good food. He presented a pair of cloths to each bhikkhu, and he presented a triple robe to the Venerable Ananda, and he had a dwelling worth 500 built for the Venerable Ananda. So that's the end of that sutta. Does anyone have any questions about that sutta? Yes. Well, I think you'll hear Acham Brahm saying that the first jhana is the first jhana by any name. There is a commentarial exposition which says that that you can only go to the first jhana with loving kindness, but I've heard what Acharya Brahm presents is that if you go into a jhana, you go into a jhana. It doesn't matter how you get there. It's not the means that you get there that makes the jhana. Once you're in the jhana, and especially once you become familiar with it, that's the first jhana by any means, by any other name. What I'm saying is that the vehicle into it is irrelevant. Yes, yes.
Is that why it's evident if you really love someone in a generous way, or the result of devotion, that it can actually lead not only to good relationship, but also concentrate the mind?
It concentrates the mind, because what we delight in, we are able to keep focused on. And so if we really delight in something, we can give it a lot of attention. We can give it enough attention to get absorbed into it. That's why I've been encouraging this weekend even to take that approach to the breath. Because if we have hold the breath as something that's delightful or dear or precious, then we're more likely to be able to stay focused on it. But any object is like that. We're able to stay with what we like. And if we cultivate these states, then we like a lot more than we like. We like a whole range of things. It's not a matter of liking it. It's a matter of allowing it to be. That's one of the qualities of loving kindness that one experiences. It's not that one likes necessarily a person or likes a situation or likes a thing, but one can allow it to be as it is, without denigrating it or trying to manipulate it to make it be what we'd like it to be. The quality of loving kindness isn't that we love everything or approve of everything, but that we can allow it to be as it is. Yes, yes. Yes, it's once we start to expand the mind with loving kindness and even with compassion, we see things that we may not have noticed about a person before. So someone that might irritate us, and our reaction always to them is, because of past experience, to be on guard with them or to feel on edge when we're around them or whatever. Once, when with more loving kindness and the development of that inner spaciousness, when we come into their orbit, we're not so affected by them. We sort of, it's like the water rolling off a duck's back. And then we can, instead of just shying away or jumping away from them or jumping on them, depending on what we've done with them previously, we might be able to notice some things about them which we've never noticed, facets about them that aren't so unlikable or that are helpful or positive or whatever, or that we can see more why they are like they are and, allow that to be. So you start to be able to do that with all sorts of situations. So if you're sitting in traffic and you've got a heart that's not just full of loving kindness, but which is actually feeling buoyant and you're feeling happy, then you don't get so upset about the fact that you're sitting in traffic. Whereas if you're miserable and you feel, depleted, then you get not only miserable that you're sitting in traffic, you get angry with the people that are next to you in the traffic. And so it's hard to put into words just how all-round beneficial these things are, because they're qualities of being. They're something that's a feeling, and that's the point of these of trying to understand these Brahma Viharas, that we're talking in words, but we're actually pointing towards a feeling state, which is much closer to an emotion of buoyancy. So it's like talking about when you're in love with someone. You know, you're in love with that person, and that's the word you say, but the feeling that goes with it is something that's quite special and hard to convey. You know, how do you feel when you're in love with someone, and how do you perceive them, the person that you're in love with? It's quite different from how you feel about when you're not in love. That affects so many of your, attitudes and behaviors, and the way you perceive things, and the way you perceive that person is very colored by your in-loveness of that person. You just look at them and see them differently from everyone else around you, and it feels different. And if you were asked, you know, what's it feel like to be in love, you might say, oh, wonderful. But, you know it feels some way. It's not just a word describing something, and that's what we're trying to approach with getting some understanding of these Brahma Viharas. It's a feeling. Yes, I see. Boundless state, what does it mean? First of all, we're talking very often in terms of categories, moving the boundaries further and further away from just being our self-centered self and thinking only of the people that are very close to us, or the people that we know, or the people that we like. And so we're moving the boundaries out so that we're encompassing a much wider field of beings as the recipients for our loving kindness, or actually who we include in our loving kindness. But as we're doing that, the internal experience is that our own mind expands. And so it's not just that we're including other categories, it's that our mind expands to encompass a much wider field of reality. Yes. Yes. Yes, well, ultimately the mind is boundless, one would say. Keeping it bounded. Yes, yes. 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 Now, these are the very highest states, which I have no personal experience, and I can only try to do my best to explain. Paragraph 12, again, with the complete surmounting of perceptions of form, with the disappearance of perceptions of sensory impact, with non-attention to perceptions of diversity, aware that space is infinite, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the base of infinite space. So in that non-material attainment, one is no longer paying attention to things or to forms that arise as, well, as things that one can perceive through any of the senses. And so you are not in that, to attain that sort of state, you're no longer paying attention to things. You're no longer filling up your perception with things. The non-attention to perceptions of diversity means the different characteristics or qualities of the various things that exist in your experience. So At a mundane level, you say hearing's taking place, and so you're listening to sounds, and then you're listening to different kinds of sounds, the diversity of sounds. You're looking at the characteristics of the pitch of the different sounds that you can hear. They're the qualities of those diverse perceptions. And so you're no longer paying attention to anything either in its gross form, so like sounds, or its very diverse characteristics, like its pitch, and comparing that pitch and being aware of the difference between this one and that one. Yes, yes. Yes. So you're letting go. In that sense, it's not that your boundaries are expanding, but that you're no longer paying attention to whatever it is that is creating boundaries of there's this close by and that far away and that over that side or whatever. You're no longer paying attention to anything that invades space or makes space occupies space, basically. You're paying attention not to the object. So the example is that there's space in this room and there are things in this room, and you can pay attention to all the things that are in this room, or you can ignore them and just pay attention to the space. One of the points that I was trying to make too is that to even get our head around those things, or my head around those things, you know, they're still so, it seems so removed from, what we would normally be experiencing or how we encounter life. Whereas the four Brahma Viharas are right there in our everyday experience, and we know something of them. We can get some idea of what this infinity of space is like, and especially because we've got space telescopes and all this sort of thing, our conception of how big things are or how spacious things are has been, you know, overthrown because of all of that that we've been exposed to. But to experience it directly is also not something that is part of our everyday experience. Yes. 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 I'm sorry, I didn't make that point clearly enough, and that's important to get that. It's talking about developing the Brahma Viharas to the point of jhana. That's where you're going to get the information necessary to really consider them for insight, liberating insight to arise. It's not just the cultivation in everyday life, in our ordinary consciousness, but the extraordinary consciousness that arises as a result of cultivating these to the point of absorption. So the question about which Brahma Vihara, do we cultivate them all or select one? It's usually given that we start with loving kindness because that has the sort of universal connection to see ourselves, that we all wish to be happy and that we all want to avoid suffering. We all fear pain, so we sort of select that as our common ground, if you like, and that when we have established that, then we move into developing compassion, which is to see that we're all suffering and that we all would like to be free of suffering, and then move into the mudita, the gladness in the happiness of others, because if you don't have a sense of yourself being full and complete, it's very hard to rejoice in others' success. Very often it becomes that one feels threatened by others' success or being robbed by others' success. And this is what we start to notice as we cultivate these states. Deliberately we hear the, oh no, can't do that, or not those people, or we hear what we're saying to ourselves about the limitations of it. But in terms of doing loving kindness and compassion, some people find that they're more able to develop compassion than they are first before loving kindness, because they are aware of their own suffering, or they're touched by the suffering of others, and they can easily put themselves in the place of that person and feel an emotional response to it, which is close to the compassion. So for some people, it's easier to start with compassion and then move to loving kindness. But there has to be that basic foundation of seeing oneself in others and seeing others in oneself. But for some people, it's harder to approach compassion because one has to be willing to feel the pain, and one doesn't want to. We spend all so much time and energy avoiding feeling pain. And so if you approach compassion and with a heart that's already contracted, then it's going to be just more painful. And so in order to establish the buoyancy in the mind, you do the loving kindness first, and then you can approach the pain of compassion that compassion brings forth. Well, there were many different ways of doing it. The breath is one way of doing it, so that you invest the breath with the quality of loving kindness because you appreciate that it's your connection with life and it's vital for your existence. That's the sort of meditation that I've done the last couple of days here. And then you can switch your attention to the center of the chest and have the perception that you're breathing in and out directly through the heart. So that connection with life is through the heart. And then try to, as you're being fed your life through this breath, that you're then passing that back out to others. And it's not just wishing them well, but it's this sense of all of us need this breath for life, and so we're sending out this breath. There are many different ways of doing it. Another way is just to repeat a phrase which has some meaning for you. And the way that I was teaching it in the meditation class yesterday, one of the systematic ways is to, first of all, wish for oneself, then wish, once you have generated the emotion that goes with those words, then you extend that wish to someone who's you can easily have that feeling for, not someone you're passionately involved with, but someone that you respect, someone you have gratitude towards, someone who's been a mentor or a teacher, maybe even someone from your past, like a teacher or a neighbour that you don't see now, but when you think of that person, you just naturally have a feeling of goodwill for them. Then after you've generated the feeling of loving kindness for that person, you extend it to someone who's a good friend, someone that you've got more of a warm relationship now, that again, you can bring that person to mind, and you may have your moments, but they're basically someone that you think of warmly, and you extend the wishes to them. And then the next group that you extend, once you've got this feeling going, you think of people that are in your life that you aren't particularly close to. So this group is called the neutral group. So it could be the people that are your neighbours, or the people you see at work or at the supermarket, or they're part of your life and you're aware of their existence, but you're not closely connected to them. And you try to generate the same feeling of goodwill towards them. And then the last category are the people that you have difficulties with. This group is often labelled the enemies, but it's not the people that you most deeply have ill will towards, but someone that you just have a difficult relationship with, and you try to generate the feelings of loving kindness and then compassion. The same, so you go first the loving kindness through all those categories and then the compassion through all those categories. And so you're trying to use the words and then generate the feeling. And you don't jump from category to category until you've generated that feeling, first of all for yourself and then to the person you can easily feel it for. But if it's difficult to generate it to yourself, first of all, you can try with the person that you can easily feel it towards, and then go back to yourself. But you only move to the next category when you've gone through the first group. So there are many ways to do it, and you'll know that with Achyam Brahm, he recommends that you use animals if you can't think of any human being that you feel warmly towards. And some people even use plants because they don't like human beings or children or anything else, but they like their plants, so they have developed a loving kindness towards their plants. A formless. Yes, yes, yes.
So if we decide even though the people are formless and charmless, we still should be formless.
What they're saying here with the destruction of the five lower fetters, so that with the destruction of the five lower fetters, that he would be born in the pure abodes. It says in the notes from the commentators that the last formless jhana is too subtle to be used for this cultivation. So I'm just quoting from the, I can only quote from the notes. The base of neither perception nor non-perception, which is the last of the formless jhanas, is not mentioned because it is too subtle a state for its constituent factors to be used as objects of insight contemplation. So that's what the commentator says, or the editor. So it's too subtle, because in the base of neither perception nor non-perception, to try to see its constituent elements, they're so subtle. To see their conditionality, and you would assume their conditionality, but to actually be able to know that is too subtle. They're too subtle. Formless realm, yes, yes, yes. The highest. Immaterial realms, yes. So for those of you who have time to just take note of another way in which the Brahmaviharas was used, I just wanted to again to make the point. I won't go through the whole sutta, but in the sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, in the Book of the Eights, and this is a teaching from the Buddha himself, the Buddha talks about using the Brahmaviharas as a way of preparing the mind to undertake the four foundations of mindfulness. In order to use those four foundations of mindfulness skillfully and to be able to pay attention to them with unremitting mindfulness, in this sutta the Buddha makes the point that the preparation through cultivating the Brahmaviharas makes the mind the right kind of tool to be able to do that, because when one cultivates the four Brahmaviharas, as I mentioned at the beginning, then one has much more inner contentment. One is not looking to move away to the past or the future. One is content with the present moment, and then one can focus one's attention on the object of mindfulness, and in the four foundations of mindfulness, the body, the feelings, the mind, and the mental objects of the mind, without moving away from that object. And then one can really penetrate deeply into those four foundations. And so I won't go through that sutta completely because I know that time is running out. But just to make you aware of the various ways in which, if you investigate, you will find that the Brahma Viharas are mentioned again and again as necessary, helpful components of this path to prepare the mind, to make the mind the right kind of tool to do the work of insight. Very often we want to jump to insight. We think that we just have to get a little bit of concentration and then we can start to practice vipassana. But we have to have a mind that's really well developed, that's able to stay with our objects of attention so that we can see them in a different light. And the mind that's been made great by the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas is able to do that. And not only is it able to see things, it's able to bear to see things that it doesn't want to see. It's able to bear with seeing that what it took to be permanent is impermanent. What it took to be beautiful is actually not beautiful. What it took to be belonging to a self is not belonging to a self. It has the strength of mind, the buoyancy of mind, to do that. That's the other very important asset that cultivation of the four Brahma Viharas gives to us.